Hey, so I, Tom, I asked my supporters here, my very fine supporters, to ask questions of you. And one, I thought this is a quick one that I like a lot. I've talked about it a long time ago, but I'm curious. Teresa Gomez asks, how does he balance raising kids to be skeptical while also allowing them to believe in things like Santa or the Tooth Fairy? I pick these because you have to actively participate as a parent to perpetuate this belief. If he doesn't, then how do you manage that when you're all around other people's kids? I love that question.
Yeah, I actually don't think that's as hard as you think, because I don't think kids are really good at skepticism until they reach a kind of age of reason.
Yeah.
They're just not. Like, kids are naturally, I know that they're going to be the outliers out there, and you're going to get emails from people like, oh, my kid's four, and he already,
Yeah, maybe.
But I think most kids at a relatively young age, they have a magical world that they live in. They don't know how anything works. And their world is full and fraught with magic. And these things are not incompatible, you know, Santa Claus and all the rest. It's not incompatible with how they see the world. And then slowly over time, they start to shed a lot of that magical, mystical nonsense. And that conversation actually, and that I actually think that that shedding is an important step for kids when they realize, hey, some things that I used to believe aren't true. What other things might not be true? It's not incompatible at all.
So you don't worry about it. You just kind of went along with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's really genuinely not challenging to navigate. And it's actually a very rewarding moment when they don't believe in Santa anymore. And they have, like, I remember my oldest boy, when he learned there was no Santa, he started laughing and laughing. He thought it was hilarious. He thought it was the funniest thing. He's like, that was you all along. And I was like, sure was, buddy. And he's like, ah, he thought it was hilarious. So I don't think those things are incompatible.
That's interesting. I mean, I will say that there are people who do view it as some betrayal of trust and something that's in some way damaging to your relationship with your child to lie to them. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure that's necessarily true. I guess it could be if you do something really extreme with it. But what do you think about that?
I think most of us have been raised with Santa, and when we found out it wasn't real, it didn't break our hearts. I think just the overwhelming evidence of the numbers of people who still have loving relationships with their parents,
yeah,
or who, if they don't, it's not because of the Santa issue.
Dad's alcoholism,
right? Yeah, it's not a big deal. I really have never known anybody for whom it was a
bad experience. Now, what do you think? Because I personally just have a hard time doing a whole, like, I would probably really half-ass this stuff. Like, I have a hard time investing a bunch of, like, mental energy into creating a lie for somebody. I could see trying not to spoil it, but I don't know. I mean, I might just be
it's not my jam either, yeah. You know, to be honest, like, but I go along with it.
You know what? Sorry, I just wanted to add this in. Something someone said to me on Christmas, that I found really interesting, I never thought of, was that, it is a good idea, and I'm going to do this with my kid. Now, I'm not telling anyone how to raise their kid, but this was an idea I thought was a good one, which is don't have the Santa Claus gifts be the expensive ones, because when your kids go to school, if it's people of different socioeconomic backgrounds and, you know, the kids are interacting and they're saying, well, why would Santa bring this kid like the expensive new whatever toy and would bring this kid like something that, you know, that was less expensive because their parents aren't well off. And I thought about that. I was like, you know what? That would be shitty. If I do the Santa thing at all, it's going to be like just the book or the clothes or the, you know, like one or two little things. And then
yeah, Santa does the stocking with us.
That's a good one. Yeah. I like that too. Like Santa just not having the new car that you buy your kid, cause you're a rich person. Like maybe don't right. have, no, I'm just, that's an exaggeration, but not, I actually thought that was a really thoughtful thing to do, to try not to contribute to some, you know, some kid just really feeling shitty about themselves because, like, you know, Santa didn't value them as much as some other kid. I thought it was interesting, but, all right. Another question actually by Teresa that I like. You both live in pretty liberal places. Does living where your opinions are shared mean you talk more or less about politics or social issues? Are they just more nuanced discussions? I live in a very conservative suburb of Houston, so I typically avoid it in public and get beyond excited to make a friend that is also a liberal. Do you feel like you're in an echo chamber? I love this question because it's so weird to me to when I talk to people who live in the South, it's like, ah, shit, you're right. That's totally different than my life. And I forget that all the time. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, about I forget that too. Yeah. All of my friends, it's not easy. It's not difficult for me to find liberals to talk to. My default assumption, to be honest, is that most people are going to be roughly politically similar to myself. They may not be religiously similar, but most people are at least open to the idea of atheism that I meet, you know? So I talk about whatever I feel like talking about, unless I'm at work, which is, you know, where it'd be inappropriate. It's really a total non-issue for me.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was wondering, one thing I was going to add, and I don't know if this is the same for you, but for California, and I think a lot of places, liberal versus conservative tends to be more about city versus country, you know, like it the big cities, even in Texas, are more liberal than, you know, they might not be like the most liberal in the country, but they're more liberal than conservative. And what's weird about where I live is it is so close, to just valley farm bullshit, rural California. Like California really is quite rural for a lot of it. And then of course the, you know, Southern California, LA, the massive, just conglomerations of people living together. But for a lot of California, it's these small towns, it's this farmland. And I'm actually, for as much as California is a blue state, it is so unbelievably focused in San Francisco and LA, and places in LA, not all of LA, by the way, but, most of it, that it's actually kind of the opposite. I always assume I might be talking to a conservative. It's kind of weird, but I found that to be the case. I think age has a lot to do with it. I kind of might profile a little bit if I'm gauging who I want to express a political opinion to, you know, younger kids in their 20s or up to my age. I guess I still think of myself as a kid, but people in their 20s and maybe my age are so overwhelmingly anti-Republican. I think most everywhere, but especially in California, that's a different story. But if it's, you know, if it's someone in their 50s, I usually just assume they're a conservative because there are so many small town conservatives in California. Is that true for you at all?
I guess the small towns. Yeah, you know, like here, Chicago Metro is basically like a 7-county region. And in the Chicago metro region, there are certainly conservative enclaves, and those conservative enclaves typically are wealthy areas where they're trying to preserve their money. So they're not necessarily socially conservative, but they will vote conservative because they're trying to conserve, you know, that wealth. They're trying to solidify that base of wealth. Outside of those areas, Chicago metro is by and large, that 7-county area is by and large pretty damn liberal. When you move out of the metro area and you go into the exurbs and into the, because you, I'm sure it's very similar to what you just described. I mean, you walk across the street from the county line in some of these, and it's just fucking corn for 100 miles. Yeah. You know, and that's not an exaggeration. Like you can, there are parts of Illinois where you can drive easily 100 miles in a dead straight line and be surrounded by nothing but corn. You can't.
Who's eating all this? Who's eating all this fucking corn? No, it's all gone. It's all subsidized. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that is extremely conservative, but it also doesn't count because no one lives there. Yeah. I mean, but I'm being serious. Yeah. Like it literally makes no difference from a numerical perspective.
Right, right.
Nobody cares. It's like, yeah, there's a farmhouse every 6 miles. All right. Well, there's nobody out here.
Yeah, as it should be, by the way, because we should care about, you know, what people's actual opinions are, not square footage. As a Republican, I debated on the show, trying to tell me about the Electoral College. It's like, well, this, you know, the area. It's like, Why do I care about the political views of an area? Like, I care about how many people are in that area and what they think.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, let's get to the meat and potatoes here, because there was a post you had that someone actually asked about. Now, maybe I can, rather than reading your post, maybe this question will be sufficient to get everybody up to speed. But if not, feel free to elaborate. But Christine Garam asks, how do we create a space for men to talk about problems that affect men disproportionately without entertaining the lunatic MRAs and without putting said men in a position to use that space to shut down women's issues as the MRAs do? What kind of an effect do either of you feel it has had on men who are not lunatic MRAs to be between and the rock and the hard place of not being able to talk about men's issues without pissing off a feminist who has been shell-shocked into reacting like it's yet another shout-down of her issues? Because I think that's what it is. Real feminists care about men's issues too, but we've been assaulted with them like weapons for years, so we're a bit jumpy at this point. But also being unwilling to talk to MRA types about them because, as previously stated, they don't actually care about men's issues, they're just lunatics. Little rambly, but I think a lot of good points in there. What do you think?
Yeah, I will say this. I think that we are in an interesting space socially right now, in an interesting time where we are very rightly looking at the roles of men and women, and we're trying to be say, like, hey, you know, there's some shit here that is grossly unacceptable, and a lot of it is this sort of
led you to write that post about expectations? Well,
because we're in this space where we're recognizing that the way that we have treated women is abhorrent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we are asking, what decent people are saying, is like, hey, let's notice these things, let's pay attention to them, let's call these things out when they happen. Let's call out the people that are behaving inappropriately, and let's pay attention here. And I think that's important. I think we have to do that. I think you can't do that and not also pay attention. You can't have a conversation about gender and not have a conversation that it includes both genders. And I think that we do a mediocre at best job of that. I think we are very rightly asking men to transcend in many ways the ways that they have been socialized, and the ways that men, and again, this is just speaking in broad terms, not all people are socialized the same way. Not all people have the same social experiences. I recognize this. Again, forgive me, I'm speaking in very broad terms.
Yeah.
But I think that it's only that if we're going to say, hey, look, the ways that men and women interact frequently are dysfunctional and inappropriate and damaging. I think that's true. And I think we need to be conscious of that. And I think we need to point that shit out when it happens. And I think we need to then ask, well, where does it come from? And part of where it comes from is the way that men are socialized, right? Like, why are these things happening? Well, we socialize men in these generally frequently dysfunctional ways. Well, we should change that. If that's something we want to change, if we want to ask, because I don't think it is reasonable to just say, well, just transcend the way that you have been socialized. And then also we'll just continue to socialize the next generation the same way and hope that they also will transcend the way that they're socialized, rather than saying, let's take a look and see, and then try to understand where we each come from and how we each grew up and what systems socially are in place to reward certain behaviors. And let's try to think about what parts of those systems we still like and what parts of those systems we need to throw away and the effects that they have upon us. And, you know, one of the frustrations that I had is I wrote a post that was very specifically about the male experience, and it was not a woe is me post. It was just like, hey, here are some contradictions in the experience of how men are socialized. And I think some of these things need to be addressed. And if we don't address them, we are not going to have real conversations about gender roles going forward. We're not going to fix some of these issues that we really need to fix. And I got, there were so many like really supportive sort of comments on there. And there were a handful of people that were just like, hey, we can't have this conversation. This is a conversation. You're not having the conversation I want you to have. You just can't have it. And that was a minority voice.
Yeah.
But it's a frustrating voice. And I understand Christine's question. And I also understand where it comes from that minority voice, because that MRA shit has almost poisoned the well.
Right, right. Absolutely. I think in fairness, and I think Christine highlighted this as well, people are used to this reactionary way that things are brought up. And what I think has frustrated me a lot is the people who haven't bothered to voice any support for victims or for people who are coming out, finally speaking up about, sexual harassment and sexual violence and Me Too and all that. Nary a word ever in support of anything like that until there's one instance that they think maybe it's not quite right. Like maybe someone made some allegation that doesn't seem to be supported or whatever.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then they jump on that and call it a witch hunt. And it's like, that's what frustrates me. And I know it's very clear when people are doing this, the sort of anti-feminists, it's not as though, right. I mean, anyone who didn't post a bunch of stuff is evil. I'm just saying it's very, the people who have this agenda of, I don't care about all the good things that are coming out of this Me Too moment, which there are a ton of good things. There are a ton of people and there are a ton of predators who have been just getting away with disgusting shit forever. And now they aren't. And that's a really good thing. That doesn't mean that it's this unambiguously forever perfect good thing that we know how to manage. You know, that doesn't mean there aren't people trying to weaponize false claims and there aren't, challenges involving how do we figure out like how mad should we be at someone who did something and then like, apologize, should we forgive them? There's all these questions that are totally valid, but to point to only the problems with it and to dismiss everything else, like all the good that has come of it, is very frustrating to me. It strikes me as just that wanting to go back to the 50s when you just, the men at work got away with whatever the hell, it strikes me as that kind of thing.
Here's the thing. I just feel very strongly that if these are real conversations we want to have about, hey, women are facing this and have faced for who knows how long, all of time, probably, an epidemic of sexual assault. Like, I think that's a conversation that absolutely needs to be had. That conversation, though, and this makes me crazy, that conversation is not a conversation that is in opposition to, hey, let's also have a conversation, and it's not a reaction conversation. It is a separate conversation about the way that we socialize men, about the systems, the social systems that reward certain behaviors for men. Let's look at whether or not those things serve us as a society, serve us as men, serve us as women who interact with men. We need to be able to have all of these kinds of conversations. That's really what gender studies is.
Yeah.
Gender studies is not, let's just look at the most oppressed group. I'm not suggesting that men are an oppressed group, and I wasn't suggesting it in my post. But what I am saying is that all of these gender systems, all of these social systems and the way that we create and conceptualize gender, they are all problematic, and they all need some examination. And as a man, I only feel qualified to speak to the male experience. I would never dare to speak to the female experience. I thought it was really interesting that when I crafted my post, which was extremely carefully crafted, I had two people read it before I posted it to make sure that there wasn't anything sort of accidentally embedded in it.
Mm-hmm.
And still some of the reaction to it was kind of a, this is why we can't have nice things. And I was so frustrated by some of that. And it unfortunately, what that does is, and social media is really bad about this because in real life this wouldn't happen. What that did is it ate up a lot of my time and energy combating that nonsense. And it distracted me from the 10 times as many people who had interesting things to say. And it's funny because in real life, I would have told that guy to go. Or that handful, I would be like, you're not welcome in this conversation. It's the big kids' table. Go lay down.
And that's almost another topic in itself, because when it's one of these topics that, as you just illustrated, you're very sensitive about, like you didn't want to, you know, offend anybody, say the wrong thing, give people a wrong impression, you know, to the point where you were revising and having people read it. It's those posts that we're most sensitive about, where that squeaky wheel that just kind of says, ah, oh, this is blah, you know, without any even really an argument. Like, none of them were even good arguments. The ones that I saw were just like, I'm trying to remember, but it was essentially just that policing, like, this is not, stop right. talking about, like, yeah. let's this talk about something else.
One of the things was like, we can't have this conversation unless we have a conversation about the fact that women are sexually assaulted. Mm-hmm. And the conversation I was trying to have was, you know, like, largely, and I don't want to read the whole post, but it was largely, look, you know, there are ways that men are socialized and social rewards and systems in place that are damaging to men's
right.
ability to navigate this new world, right? So we need to do a better job understanding what those things are, understanding their impact on men in general, in order for us to say, because there are many men who can transcend that socialization, but there are still many more who will not be able to. And unless we see that, identify it, recognize the pieces that are good, throw away the pieces that are bad, and socialize our next generation of men and women differently. If we don't do that, all this is pointless.
Hmm.
All this means nothing. If we don't do that, if we don't take that step, then we're chimpanzees. All we're doing is teaching each other how to fish for fucking termites out of the anthill again and again, right? If you have to learn the same fucking trick every generation, you didn't learn anything.
Yeah.
So we have to do a better job.
Well, and
you
that's why
you can't do a better job by teaching everybody the same fucking trick over and over and over again and hoping that things will just change.
I think you nailed it when you said that's what gender studies is. I mean, I think it's fascinating to look at the ways that both men and women, and by the way, anyone who is non-binary, people who are trans people, all that, to look at the ways that they interact with society and that society and just people in everyday social interactions make them feel for what they do. You know, when it's a man who wants to take time off of work to be with their baby, how is that man made to feel? You know, how
but
is
you
that
know,
just
like, I
like
will
that.
Talk about it from a very privileged standpoint. Sure. Like, I am in many ways, I benefit from many of the traditional social advantages of how maleness and masculinity are conceptualized and socialized, right? I have a pretty masculine frame. I have a relatively masculine voice. I'm pretty assertive. I'm very naturally assertive. It comes comfortably to me. You know, I have a lot of the traditional trappings of traditional masculinity as socialized from men, right? And I'm rewarded all the time for that stuff. I'm rewarded all the time for being this kind of man, right? That in no way makes those rewards less visible to me if I'm thoughtful. It in no way makes those rewards fair or socially desirable. Some of them are, but some are not. And if we, again, it's like if we are not careful and thoughtful and explicit about seeing these things and having conversations about which of these serves us socially, psychologically, emotionally, otherwise, if we don't have those conversations, then we tacitly accept them and we don't change. And this is coming from a guy who is winning, right? Like I'm an upper middle class, heterosexual, masculine white male. The world loves me and always will. But I need to see that, right? And like we need to have those conversations. And I also think that as much as the world loves me and will reward me for this, I also see the ways that I'm hamstrung by this.
Yeah.
And that's conversation too, because if I'm hamstrung and I'm sitting at the top of the food pyramid, so to speak, then other people who don't have those same advantages are more hamstrung than I am, right? Because they don't get those same rewards. And they eat the shit that I eat. So even if I eat very little shit, I think we still have to have the conversations because I don't think I want anyone eating shit.
You know, to try to tie it all together, I think the answer is, I think that's all very well stated. I think the answer is that, A, we need to be able to have these conversations cooperatively rather than competitively. And as you and as the listener pointed out, when it's done as a competition, that's a problem. When it's done as a, oh, well, okay, sure, there's harassment, but did you know men have to pay for dates or, you know, it's like, okay, if we're going to try to get into some pissing match over, you know, who has it worse, like that's when it's being done to try to take right. away from what feminists are working toward. And, but I think the answer is, how do we have these conversations? Well, I think you did a really good job. And I think you hit it on the head when you said this kind of squeaky wheel diverted your attention. And what I was saying earlier was that happens when you are talking about something sensitive. It's very easy for somebody to capitalize on your sensitivity. And this happens to me all the time, which is to say, to make a not very thoughtful criticism about what you're talking about. And then you're just fighting uphill, like, oh shit, no, I'm not sexist, I'm not saying blah blah blah. I think that if we put that person aside and ignore that, I think it was a great conversation. As you said, it was done in a way that was not competitive with other interests, was not trying to take away from something, was trying to add to something. And I think we can definitely do that, but it is true that people are really sensitive about it, you know, and it's true that people can
And that's that call you names. Like, you just, yeah. Like it's funny, like the example you just gave, right? Like, you know, men have to pay for dates, but women are being sexually assaulted. Like those two, what we need to understand is those two things don't relate to each other. Yeah. We need to have those conversations, but we need to understand that those, you know, because I will tell you, like the men pay for dates, like embedded in that, I think there are some really interesting conversations that underlie, like, how is a man's social status affected by his material worth, right? And how does that differ? And how does his attractiveness affect?
I have to chime in and say they are a little bit related, and they can be related because of the entitlement thing. Like, there are people, there are men who think, oh, if I paid for this, then that means I'm
right.
But I guess what I mean is
we can have those conversations as they relate to each other, but we can also have those conversations in ways that are interesting and honest. And that are independent of one another. And I think that we should. I think we should absolutely look at them. And if at the end of the day, if we look at something and we say, yeah, okay, all those things are true, and I'm okay with them all, then that's okay too.
Yeah.
But what I don't think we should do is just shrug and say, that's the way it is, and not be thoughtful about it.
Yeah. I think it just shows that gender studies is an interesting field, and there's a lot to talk about and a lot to look into. But Tom, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you so much for both a great conversation on the main show and then a fantastic conversation on the bonus content. I feel guilty for how much of your time I've taken up, but it is awesome and it's great to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Thomas.